Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio, a public affairs program dedicated to bringing you speeches recorded from around the state, given by experts lecturing on topics from environmentalism and sustainability to the global economy, politics, and beyond. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today's program features a recent presentation of the World Affairs Council of Maine. The speaker is Ribal Al-Assad, founder and director of the Organization for Freedom and Democracy in Syria. His talk is titled, Syria, the Middle East, and the New Cold War: How Three Tiers of Conflict Created an Apocalypse. Introducing the speaker is Amy Holland, executive director of the World Affairs Council.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Global Insights program presented by the World Affairs Council of Maine. I'm Amy Holland, Executive Director of the Council, and I'm pleased to see such a wonderful crowd here for this unique opportunity to hear from and ask questions of Ribal Al-Assad. The World Affairs Council of Maine is a nonpartisan membership organization dedicated to connecting Maine and the world. Our council provides a wide variety of opportunities for discussion, networking, education, and community building around international issues. Our speaker programs and other events engage our members and the wider community in civil discourse and critical thinking that are so essential in our world today. We host speakers with different backgrounds, experience, and perspectives with the goal of engaging in a conversation that helps us develop a deeper understanding of complex global issues and of each other. Our speaker tonight certainly has a unique background. Ribal Al-Assad is the founder and director of the Organization for Democracy and Freedom in Syria and the founder and chairman of the Iman Foundation, which promotes global intercultural dialogue. He has lived in the West since being exiled from his native Syria as a child. He is a regular speaker on Syrian politics and how the current conflict is shaped by regional and geopolitical dynamics. Ribal was born in Damascus and is first cousin to current President Bashar al-Assad, but has been a lifelong political opponent of the regime. He graduated from the Inter-American University in New York and earned his master's in international relations from the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom. He now lives in London. Please join me in welcoming him to Maine.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Amy. Thank you very much, everyone, for being here. And I know how much it must have been because it took me a long time to get here, actually. I was in Paris, then London, then Washington, D.C. And this morning I met my old friend from Boston who studied with me when we were in Boston, Lordi, who lives in Montreal. So it's really a great pleasure and honor to be amongst you, ladies and gentlemen. I've prepared a little speech, so I hope it's not going to be, I wanted to explain things, in a better way that I think you'll understand how the situation in the Middle East has evolved and how it's not only today in concentrated in the Middle East, but it's a regional conflict, and it has dragged in countries such as the United States and Russia. Thank you, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to thank the Portland World Affairs Council for the kind invitation to speak to you at this important event, which I am, of course, delighted to attend. I want to speak to you tonight about the current crisis in Syria, the Middle East, and indeed the rest of the world, since it has become increasingly clear that the conflicts in Syria and the region are having significant global repercussions. Afterwards, I look forward to hearing what I'm surely will be very insightful questions and then doing my very best to answer them. Before I begin, I want to say a few words about Islamism, which is a term you will hear a lot in the speech that follows. Islamism is a political ideology that has corrupted and perverted the religion of Islam to suit its own vicious ends. So when Islamists claim to be acting in the name of Islam when they attack close to home in cities like Boston, New York, San Bernardino, or abroad, as in Paris and Brussels, you shouldn't believe them. These people are not telling the truth. The truth is that Islam is a religion of peace based on mercy and forgiveness. I am Muslim, and I can tell you that my religion does not sanction the murder of innocents or any of the other violence and oppression the Islamists themselves actually worship. With this made clear, I want to move on to the topic of Syria and explain how what began in that country as a government clampdown on a peaceful protest movement was transformed into a vicious proxy war between external powers pursuing their own interest, and how this external interference has gradually drawn in global powers, including Russia and the United States. For, as you all know, in recent months, Russia has become much more active in Syria, intervening directly to support the regime with 5,600 airstrikes as of mid-January, and an average of 100 missions per day since then. This is twice the number of sorties that have been flown by the US and its allies, which have mostly been in support of Kurdish fighters who are actually allies with the regime. And even though the coalition's objectives are more limited than Russia's focus, as they are on helping the Kurds to tackle the Islamic State, it's clear that its efforts are not enough to be truly effective, especially when you compare them with the air campaign carried out in Afghanistan and Iraq, which were some 40 times the intensity of the coalition's current mission in Syria. Until very recently, the US and Russia have taken directly opposing position on the regime, with Russia committed to supporting it and the US committed to an opposition that, despite all hopes, is not moderate at all. And although lately we have seen some signs of cooperation between the two countries over the conflict in Syria, tensions between them remain very high. Indeed, it was only 2 months ago that Russian Prime Minister Medvedev warned at the Munich Security Conference that a new world war would break out if NATO ground troops were to enter Syria, which is a scenario Turkey seemed to have been doing its best to bring about. Its shooting down of a Russian jet last November, for example, was clearly an attempt to drag NATO into the conflict. It's worth noting that since the day the Russian jet was downed, Turkish incursions of Greek airspace, which before that day had numbered over 2,000, were completely stopped. But Turkey's gambit to drag in NATO failed, and actually just gave the Russians a convenient excuse to deploy to Syria their S-400 air defense missile system, which is far more advanced than the S-300 system the West has long worried Russia would deliver to the Syrian regime. This means that Russia has now imposed a de facto no-fly zone over Syria, and now any country flying over the country has to cooperate with the Russians. This is all in addition to Russia having state-of-the-art tanks and artillery on the ground, not to mention the submarine and the cruiser Moskva in the Mediterranean. But there is still a significant danger that the conflict would escalate into a more serious clash between Russia and the United States. I sincerely hope that this danger will be averted, however, and that instead the international community can come together to confront our common enemy, which, as I will make it clear in this speech, is global Islamic extremism. That will be the first step in bringing lasting peace to my country and the wider region, which is necessary for its people to begin their journey to true freedom and democracy. But before I go on to talk about how the international community must respond today and tomorrow to the crisis in my country and about how it affects our own national security, let me look back to yesterday and talk a little about how this tragic situation came about. As you are aware, the present conflict began in 2011 with a series of protests against the regime, which were widely interpreted in the context of the so-called Arab Spring. And many Syrians were indeed crying out for democratic reform. These good people didn't dream of igniting civil war when they took the street, but sadly their protests were hijacked by those who had a very different and much more sinister agenda. And democratic leaders on the ground were pushed to the side by radicals committed to sectarian war and the imposition of brutal Sharia law. Which is why to this day the overwhelming majority of the so-called opposition forces on the ground are in fact Islamic extremists. These extremists, I should add, are the first to admit that they love death and want nothing more than to kill and to die in the service of their twisted ideology. And we need to remember that their ambitions are by no means limited to Syria, but their goal is to establish an Islamic caliphate under Sharia law which stretches from Xinjiang, China, to Andalusia, Spain, everywhere, in fact, where they see themselves as a majority. So how exactly would this movement for freedom and democracy hijacked by jihadis who have absolutely no respect for freedom or human rights or the democratic process? The answer is that powerful regional players have intervened in the conflict and are now effectively fighting a proxy war on Syrian soil using these jihadists as their pawns. As I'm sure you all know, the major rivalry in the Middle East is between Iran on one side and the Gulf states and Turkey on the other, and all of these states are shamefully complicit in the catastrophe that has engulfed Syria and the wider Middle East, having manipulated the sectarian divide between Sunni and Shia Muslims to further their own interests. One reason for the involvement of the Gulf state is that they fear the democratic forces unleashed by the Arab Spring with its calls for dignity and popular representation, and worried that similar uprising could threaten their own autocratic and repressive regimes through a kind of domino effect. Hence, from the very beginning, they made sure that extremist element infiltrated the Syrian opposition and used jihadist TV station to foment sectarian war rather than genuine democratic change. Another reason for their intervention is that the leader of Turkey and the Gulf states all believed that by intervening in Syria, they could bring down the regime in a matter of months, thereby isolating Iran and bringing its nuclear program to a halt. They also hoped to ensure that the new system would not be democratic and would be under their control. So they began competing with each other in their support for radical Islamist groups inside Syria, who they expected to do their bidding when the regime fell. Clearly, not everything has gone accordingly to their plan. Now that Iran has signed its nuclear deal with the US, it is, in some ways, a partner of the West rather than its implicable enemy. And with sanctions on the way to being lifted, it's much better placed to further the strategy of expansion it has been pursuing since the invasion of Iraq, which, I should add, effectively handed Iran's control of most of that country. Iran is also now able to help finance Russia's intervention in Syria, and better placed to deploy more of its own ground troops in the country. And remember that Iran still has an alliance with Russia as well, which is about to supply it with the S-300 missile system, as well as a cadre of Sukhoi fighter jets and other advanced weaponry. Iran also recently announced that it had signed contracts with Russia worth a total of around $40 billion for a variety of industrial and infrastructure projects. And while some observers have speculated that Iran's intervention in Syria was about securing the nuclear program, if anything, the reverse is true. Iran's nuclear program, like its intervention in Syria, is only a means to an end, namely the domination of the greater Middle East from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean. And ironically, the rise of Salafi extremism, the Arab Spring, has only helped Iran because minorities throughout the region have heard the hateful sectarian rhetoric coming from top clerics on satellite TVs and other media owned by the Gulf states, and they have seen the wholesale slaughter of minority groups, whether Christians, Alawites, Kurds, Shias, Druze, Ismailis, Yazidis, not to mention the suffering of the peaceful majority of the Sunnis who reject the Islamists' ideology. So it's hardly a surprise that minorities across the entire region have begun turning to Iran in the hope of protection from the growing Islamist menace, which is, of course, a role the Iranians are only too happy to take up by sending arms, money, and men to their proxies and allies. I hope by now it's clear that the unintended and self-defeating consequence of Turkey's and the Gulf countries' support for Islamist groups in Syria has ultimately been to aid Iran in its quest to dominate the greater Middle East. But where was the democratic Western world when the seeds of this great mess were sown back in 2011? Unfortunately, the West was so badly disorganized with policies for Syria that were uninformed and poorly focused. In fact, then US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, along with many other Western leaders, recognized the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated Syrian National Council. But it took Ms. Clinton 18 months to realize that the Syrian National Council did not represent the Syrian people, by which time, of course, Islamist fighters were busy tearing Syria apart. But this outcome was to be expected from an opposition dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, whose flag, we should remember, clearly states what the group stand for, which statement proclaiming that Allah is our objective, the Prophet is our leader, the Quran is our law, jihad is our way, and dying in the name of Allah is our greatest hope. And they kind of publicize themselves as the moderate Muslims. But nothing was learned from this, because soon afterward, the Syrian National Coalition was formed in Qatar, where the so-called representatives of the Syrian people were once again handpicked by regional powers, including the Salafi Wahhabi elements that were added only to please the Saudi. None of this was undertaken with genuine democracy and representation in mind, by the way, which raises the question as to how such an opposition really differs from the current regime. In terms of opposition fighters on the ground, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, described the rebels early in 2012 as not a national movement, deeply fractured and infiltrated by al-Qaeda. And General Dempsey admitted that none of the rebel groups in Syria shared our interests. And in 2013, Secretary of Justice Eric Holder confirmed that the Free Syrian Army had imbibed the ideology of al-Qaeda. And General Lloyd Austin III pointed out that the conflict in Syria cannot be resolved militarily, with the added warning that, and I quote, left unchecked, the spread of violence and terrorist activity emanating from Syria could result in a long, drawn-out conflict that extends from Beirut to Damascus to Baghdad to Yemen. But as late as September of that year, the new Secretary of State, John Kerry, was still claiming at a Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting that there was no al-Qaeda presence in Syria, despite the fact that its presence had been established beyond all doubt. Clearly, the West has not been on top of its game. But unfortunately, the lessons that should have been learned have not been learned. And it remains the case that Western policy in the Middle East is poorly focused and detached from reality on the ground. Consider Libya, for instance, where, according to U.S. Army General David Rodriguez, the Islamic State has doubled in size over the last year and a half. Yemen is another depressing example. After years of fighting al-Qaeda in Yemen, the United States' efforts are being completely undermined because the Saudis are once again building up al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, and other extremist groups to use as proxies in the war against the Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Because of the Saudis' policies, even Islamic State has been able to establish a foothold in the country. And then, of course, there is Syria. The Obama administration more or less admitted this last year when it announced a $500 million program to create a new moderate rebel force in Syria, after concluding that its half-hearted efforts backing existing forces over the past 5 years have had practically no impact, and realizing that even supposedly vetted fighters have ended up either running away or handing over their weapons to the likes of al-Nusra. But just a few months later, the administration abandoned this program too, with General Lloyd Austin III telling a dumbstruck U.S. Senate committee that the number of fighters trained by the U.S. who were actually capable of battling the Islamic State was only around 4 or 5. It's clear that after so many years of allowing our supposed allies to promote sectarianism and to incite hatred and killing of minorities and all those who do not share their perverted ideology, it's simply too late to create an all-inclusive national force from scratch. So we shouldn't be surprised when groups such as D-30 and the Hazm Brigades surrender their U.S. weapons and sign up to the Nusra Front, and neither should we criticize the Russians for bombing supposedly moderate rebels when again and again they have been proven to be Islamic extremists. Indeed, we in the West have managed things so badly in Syria that General Lord Dennett, the former chief of UK General Staff, has recently suggested that we begin working with the regime because, in his word, that is the least worst of several very unattractive options. And he is not alone in that assessment. The former UK ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, has also said that the West has to stop propping up the so-called moderate opposition, which he claims is not moderate at all. But such advice has generally gone unheeded. In fact, some have even begun to argue the West should back Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the Syrian affiliate of al-Qaeda. These people seem to believe that if al-Nusra can be persuaded to polish its image and rebrand itself to appear less viciously sectarian, then suddenly it will become a suitable ally for the democratic world. So while even men as distinguished as General David Petraeus might suggest using the al-Nusra to fight Islamic State, with all due respect, I must strongly disagree, because at the end of the day, this idea is not a sign of strategic thinking, but simply a sign of desperation. Jabhat al-Nusra, we must remember, is a branch of al-Qaeda, and it was al-Qaeda, not the Islamic State, which was responsible for 9/11. It was al-Qaeda which was responsible for the 7/7 attacks in London, and it was again al-Qaeda which was responsible for the Madrid train bombing, the Mumbai attacks, and so many others. Actually, one of the foremost advocates of providing the Syrian rebels with military support was Ambassador Robert Ford, the former U.S. ambassador to Syria, and even he has admitted that the result of doing so have been disastrous. Ford said in February last year that for too long the U.S. has looked the other way while the groups they were backing in Syria worked alongside the Nusra Front. They did so because they naively believed that al-Nusra's backers in Turkey and Qatar, who said they were homegrown anti-regime forces, unlike the Islamic State. But as he now admits, Nusra Front is just as dangerous. And yet, they keep pretending they're nice guys, they're Syrians. WikiLeaks cables have revealed... Indeed, the whole idea that there was some good Islamist and bad Islamist, or good terrorist and bad terrorist, is a very dangerous one, as the terrible blowback from US support for Islamists during the Soviet-Afghan war really should have taught us. Thankfully, however, the view that we should support violent Islamist fanatics committed to the West's destruction remains a minority in the United States, but the same cannot be said of such a view in the Middle Eastern countries that we call our allies. Qatar, for example, has funded and armed Jabhat al-Nusra for many years, and it has long called for the West to recognize the group as moderate and promoted its leader on Al Jazeera, allowing him to spread his hateful message, all despite its being listed as a terrorist organization by the US. So rather than thanking Qatar for acting as a mediator whenever al-Nusra takes hostages, we should really listen to Sir Malcolm Rifkin, the former chair of the UK Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee, who was completely right to point out that Qatar's role in promoting terrorism and to insist that the Qataris must choose their friends or live with the consequences. As for Saudi Arabia, it is well known that the country has long been a critical financial support base for global terrorist groups. WikiLeaks cables have revealed that individuals and institutions in Saudi Arabia have pumped up millions of dollars into extremist groups from Europe to India to Indonesia. And Hillary Clinton herself has stated that, I quote, donors in Saudi Arabia constitute the most significant source of funding to terrorist groups worldwide. Likewise, the former head of French Interior Intelligence, Yves Bonnet, has accused both Qatar and Saudi Arabia for funding extremist Islamist network in France, and Bernard Squarcini, a previous head of France's counter-espionage and counter-terrorism intelligence agency, has pointed to Saudi intelligence supporting extremist groups from Afghanistan to Lebanon and Syria to Egypt to Mali. To put it simply, Saudi Arabia's support for global terrorism is clear and undeniable. But this is hardly surprising given the fact that the kingdom's own political culture is fundamentally Islamist. Actually, Islamic State and Saudi Arabia both follow the same vicious brand of Wahhabi Salafi Islam and prescribe almost identical punishment on a host of legal offenses, including death by beheading, crucifixion, stoning, and other barbaric practices. Just a couple of months ago, in fact, during an interview with Dubai TV channel, a former imam at the Grand Mosque in Mecca justified the execution by beheading of American journalists and said that Islamic State militants draw their ideas from what is written in our own books. Saudi religious figures also regularly incite hatred and violence against religious minorities across the Middle East. For example, the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia, who is the highest religious official in that country, has called in the past for the burning of all Christian churches in the Arabian Peninsula. He has also welcomed the statement from the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who, by the way, happens to live in Qatar, where he called for all Sunnis to take up arms and kill the Shias and Alawites, who he says are infidels deserving of death. These are just a couple of the many outrageous statements for which he has never been disciplined by the Saudi government, and even more shamefully, no Western leader has spoken out against this. In another incident, in October last year, over 50 Saudi clerics published a statement commanding all Muslims to join the so-called jihad against the Syrian regime, the Orthodox Russian, and Iran. So you have to remember that while the Saudis may make noises about combating sectarianism and Islamic extremism, as with their announcement last December of a new Islamic anti-terror alliance made up solely of Sunni-led states, in reality, this is just a Saudi attempt to counterbalance Iran by inflaming sectarian divisions between Sunnis, Shias, and minorities across the Middle East. This is, of course, completely unacceptable. Thankfully, a few high-profile figures in the West have begun to subject Saudi Arabia to some long-overdue criticism. German Vice-Chancellor Sigmar Gabriel, for example, last December rebuked Saudi Arabia for funding radical preachers and mosques in Germany, right noting that many dangerous Islamists come from these communities. He made clear that it was not acceptable for the Saudis to continue spreading extremism, and in his words, he said, the time to look away is past. And in a recent interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, President Obama attacked state-sanctioned Saudi misogyny and described how Islam in Indonesia, where the president spent some time of his when he was a child, had become more intolerant and exclusive as a result of the fact that the Saudis and other Gulf Arab have funneled money and large numbers of imams and teachers into the country to teach the fundamentalist version of Islam favored by the Saudis. Mr. Goldberg also says that President Obama has questioned, often harshly, the role that America's Arab allies play in fomenting anti-American terrorism, and noted that the president is clearly irritated that foreign policy orthodoxy compels him to treat Saudi Arabia as an ally. But while such statements are very true and very important, the question has to be asked, where are the consequences? A recent European Parliament vote in favor of an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia is an encouraging development, but this decision is non-binding, and in any case, it's not enough. Because too many leaders in the West are prone to using strong words without matching these words with appropriate actions. Nowhere is this more true than the case of Turkey, which has recently received some 6 billion euros in aid and promises of visa-free access to Schengen in exchange for its cooperation on the burgeoning migrant crisis, which I should add is a crisis partly of Turkey's own making, given its meddling in Syria and its constant refusal to control its own borders. Now, I mentioned earlier that Turkey has been involved in the crisis in Syria from the very beginning, the reason being that President Erdogan sees Syria as a natural starting point from which to extend Turkey's influence south into the Middle East, cutting off Iran and cementing Turkey's own role as a champion of Sunni Muslims throughout the region, in what is effectively an attempt to recreate the Ottoman Empire. And like the Gulf state, Turkey believes that jihadists and extremism are appropriate tools which she could use to achieve its foreign objectives. Besides Turkey's support for Islamist extremist groups such as al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, and many others, there is strong evidence that Turkey has been actively collaborating with the Islamic State, particularly in terms of purchasing its smuggled oil. And this is not, as President Erdogan likes to pretend, an allegation manufactured by Russia. Much to the annoyance of Mr. Erdogan, even the leader of the opposition People's Democratic Party, Salahattin Demirtas, has criticized Turkey's dealings with the Islamic State. And just this January, Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yalon said that the Islamic State has enjoyed Turkish money for oil for a very, very long time. This Turkish money has, of course, been crucial for Daesh, which is ISIS, and is what has helped it to grow to such monstrous proportions. But Turkey's links to foreign jihadists are not limited to the Middle East. Over the last 5 years, hordes of foreign volunteers have crossed from Turkey into Syria and Iraq to join the jihadists there. And according to Europol director Rob Wainwright, between 3,000 to 5,000 of these battle-hardened veterans have now returned to their home countries in the West, many hiding among the vast masses of refugees, and all thanks to Turkey's deliberately lax border controls and its support for jihadists. This is a point President Obama publicly complained about last year when he said that Turkish authorities recognize this as a problem, but haven't fully ramped up the capacity they need. Almost 1 year later, however, very little has changed. And in December, U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said that Turkey still needed to do more to control its borders. And in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, it was revealed that King Abdullah of Jordan, who is an official ally of Turkey, recently told members of US Congress that Turkey was sending Islamist extremists to Europe under the cover of refugees as a matter of policy. And what does Turkey receive for this massive breach of trust and its continuous refusal to cooperate with its allies? Nothing more than a slap on the wrist from the US, apparently, and from the European Union, mountains of money and the promise of EU accession. But as former UK Shadow Home Secretary David Davis has explained, accepting Turkey into the EU would be catastrophic mistakes. When the Muslim Brotherhood's Youssef al-Qaradawi talked a few years ago about Islam's peaceful conquest of the West, the vehicle he had in mind was Turkey's prospective EU membership. But allowing Turkey into the EU would also be a moral failure. The West should be disciplining Turkey, not rewarding it. Under President Erdogan, Turkey has become increasingly violent and unpredictable, with crackdowns on the press, the democratic opposition and freedom of speech, as well as unrelenting persecution of the country's Kurdish minorities, constant attempts to drag NATO into the conflict in Syria, and of course, the growth of Islamic radicalism. All of this has contributed to the climate of insecurity and fear that now plagues Turkey, and is a reason why President Obama has come to see Erdogan as an authoritarian whose policies have failed. But really, we shouldn't be too surprised by any of it. Erdogan began his political career as part of the Turkish Islamist movement. He has claimed in the past that democracy is just the train you board to get to your destination. And he was jailed on the charge of inciting religious hatred when he publicly recited an inflammatory poem, part of which I will now quote. He said, "The mosques are our barracks, the domes are our helmets, the minarets are our bayonets, and the faithful are our soldiers." Erdogan will, of course, continue to try to sell himself as a moderate. But his recent criticism of a U.S. House of Representatives bill labeling the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization shows that this particular leopard will never change his spots. Still, as I have warned many times, despite all of President Erdogan's sympathy and tacit support for radical Islamists, nothing will prevent extremists from targeting Turkey if they believe the need arises, which in fact they have done now on several occasions, killing and wounding many hundreds of innocent Turks. Any small step Erdogan takes to distance himself from them will invite violent retaliation from them. And besides, these people are committed to creating an Islamic caliphate under Sharia law, which is something an ostensibly secular, democratic Turkey, allied to the West, is anathema to. Erdogan has put himself in this position by deciding to support Islamists, provoking the Syrian regime to begin supporting the Syrian Kurds, whose proto-state in the north is a source of inspiration for more than 20 million Kurds in Turkey, most of whom, it is important to note, are Alawites. So you see, the Islamist threat is not just about the Islamic State and other Islamist extremist groups are doing in my country, as horrific as that is, but it's about how jihadists are being deliberately used by our so-called allies to further what they believe to be their own interest, but which is a policy that actually leads a range of self-defeating outcomes. Our allies, in short, have become serious liabilities, and this is why we must urgently rethink our geopolitical alliances and priorities, which is an undertaking that is all the more important in light of the global consequences of the Syrian conflict. But I'm afraid to say the Western strategy in this respect has been flawed from the beginning. If the West had moved early on in the conflict to take a lead by fostering a genuine democratic opposition, by calling a conference for all democratic groups who would sign up to the ideals of equality regardless of religion, sect, ethnicity, gender, and so on, it would by definition have automatically excluded Islamists from the very start, since this sort of people will always be hostile to such ideas. If the West had done this, they might now have been democratic opposition forces worthy of the name. Instead, our so-called allies were allowed to take the initiative, as I have described, inciting sectarian hatred and calling for jihad and turning Syria into a slaughterhouse. And now we are struck with the terrible result of all this. One of these terrible consequences is the refugee crisis, which is a topic I want to briefly touch on. According to the World Bank, since the beginning of the Syrian conflict, over 6.5 million of my fellow countrymen have been internally displaced, and almost 4.4 million are registered refugees. Most of these people are living in tents in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, with little food, no heaters or air conditioning, nor proper medical care, let alone education for their children. The UN estimates that almost 90% of these refugees are living in crushing poverty and have difficulty finding work permits. The UN also reported that wealthy men from the Gulf state have used the camps as a source of underage brides. In light of all this, it's hardly surprising that these families want to leave to find a better life. If only the Gulf state had redirected the billions of dollars they have spent on weapons and propaganda for Islamic extremists towards supporting the refugees. Because now, these same Islamist groups are taking advantage of the uncontrolled flow of people in order to send their fighters to Europe. As the head of Germany's domestic intelligence agency, Hans-Jörg Massen, pointed out just a couple of months ago, a number of the Paris attackers, in fact, were able to enter Europe undetected, and the ringleader of the plot even boasted about it. Just a few days ago, the EU border agency, Frontex, announced that irregular migratory flows could be used by terrorists to enter the EU. And US Immigration and Customs Enforcement has confirmed that Islamic State has access to Syrian government printing machines and blank passport, as well as biographical data and fingerprints of Syrian citizens, raising the prospect that the travel documents of many apparent refugees could actually be fake. Given the huge number of refugees, it won't be easy to screen people effectively, which is another reason why many EU governments are now talking about they're interested to talk to the Syrian regime, because at least they think they have a better idea of who these refugees are and which one could pose a threat. The saddest thing is that it didn't need to be like this. These refugees have been languishing in camps for years without receiving the assistance they needed from the international community. And still not enough is being done for them. Had the West acted early on to help these desperate people whose quest for freedom and dignity has left them homeless and destitute, then perhaps the migrant crisis would not have reached the enormous proportion it has today. And we would have shown the peaceful majority of Syrians that we are serious about giving them a better life. As a matter of fact, it would have been cheaper for us to support Syrian refugees located in neighboring countries, and the refugees would have certainly preferred to stay close to home, where they still have relatives, and to live in countries which share the same culture, where they could still speak their own language, and have the hope of returning home as soon as the conflict comes to an end. But we cannot change the past. Our priority now must be to ensure the defeat of the Islamists and bring calm to Syria, so that a peaceful transition to democracy and stability can begin. And the refugee can return to home to help rebuild their country with the full aid and support of the international community. It is here, I believe, that the US and Russia can and must work together for the good of Syria, the region, and indeed these two countries themselves. Because although I understand the arguments of those who describe Russia as the gravest threat to US national security and who are therefore wary of cooperation with President Putin, I respectfully defer and agree instead with Michael Morell, the former Deputy Director of the CIA, who said that the single biggest threat to U.S. national security at present comes from the jihadist group now returning from Syria. In terms of the bigger picture, it is indeed the case that Russia is becoming increasingly close to China, and that the relation of both of these countries with the United States have significantly worsened. But this is due to the fact that both countries feel threatened by the West. The two countries have been boosting cooperation in the military, financial, and energy sectors, increasingly switching to settlements in yuan, which will reduce the influence of the dollar on the world financial and energy markets. And not too long ago, the Chinese announced a Silk Road-style economic corridor linking China to Russia, Mongolia, and a number of other countries. Indeed, China is now directly challenging the West's policy of cutting off credit to Russia by pledging to extend financial aid to Moscow. Moreover, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu announced last November that the two countries are intent on forming a collective regional security system and planning joint naval drills, not only in the Pacific, but even in the Mediterranean. Chinese Defense Minister Chang Wangchuan has spoken of the even closer military-to-military relation between the two countries, including high-level visits, joint exercises, and professional communications. Many Russian military exercises seem to have been deliberately chosen to send a clear message to NATO and its members, with Russia's ambassador to Denmark warning that if the Danes were to sign up to NATO's missile defense program, Danish warships will be targeted by nuclear weapons. On the diplomatic front, China has backed Russia, with the Chinese ambassador to Belgium, Xu Qing, blaming the Ukraine crisis on a game being played by the Western powers and calling on them to take Russia's security concerns more seriously, which, given the planned quadrupling of U.S. defense spending in Europe, the concerns do not seem to have been registered. China is also very concerned about the United States' so-called pivot to Asia, which will include moving 60% of the U.S. Navy assets to the region, as well as other developments, such as the planned deployment of the U.S. missile defense system in South Korea and plans to sail American warships in the waters between Vietnam and the Philippines, which fuel China's fears that the U.S. is practicing a policy of encirclement. So we need to place the Syrian crisis within the framework of these issues, because these broader contexts help us to understand why China and Russia see how the Syrian conflict relates to politics in their own regions. It also helps us to understand how the Syrian conflict would become a more serious confrontation between the US and its allies on one side and Russia and China on another, which is in fact a concern that has already been raised by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Fortunately, President Obama responded to Lavrov's comments by insisting that this would not be allowed to happen, telling a White House press conference that this would be a bad strategy on our part. Indeed, as John Kerry said just a couple of weeks ago in Moscow, cooperation with Russia is in the strategic interest of the United States. This is particularly true in the terms of defeating the Islamic State, Al-Nusra, and other groups that share the same perverted ideology, because what matters is not so much the particular brand name of each group, but the vicious ideology that unites them. This poisonous ideology and the extremist organization it spawns pose a real and present danger to the United States and are, in fact, threats we share in common with the Russians and the Chinese. Indeed, Islamic extremism poses the greatest threat to world peace since the Nazis because they do not have a single army to defeat, ambassador to summon, or borders to invade, and they are growing in numbers not only in the Middle East but in all the countries I have mentioned. China, for example, faces a particular threat from Islamists in Xinjiang province, as it's believed that hundreds of, if not thousands of Chinese citizens have been fighting in Syria and Iraq. And as China's special envoy for the Middle East, Ambassador Wu Sike, has said, when these fighters return home, they will pose a severe challenge and security risk. Because of these concerns, Beijing has warned Turkey that if it continues to support these fighters, China will in turn support Kurdish rebels in Turkey. But I'm sure that everyone would prefer to see China being involved in a coordinated international effort to defeat terrorism. And there are few reasons to be hopeful that international cooperation in Syria is bearing some fruit. For despite our regional allies' constant attempt to sabotage such an outcome, Russia and the United States still managed to jointly draw up a cessation of hostilities in Syria a couple of months ago, and this has led to a marked reduction of violence in the country. And although Russia's partial withdrawal from Syria is largely symbolic, the move suggests that Russia wants to be seen as a global responsible actor that is capable of finding political solutions such as a negotiated end to the Syrian conflict. Former French Defense Minister Paul Quilles recently argued that the fall of the regime without an organized transition would lead to a Libya-type situation, the collapse of the state, chaos, then the destabilization of Lebanon and doubtless Jordan too. And he also condemned nominal Western allies like Saudi, Qatar, and Turkey for seemingly working towards that very outcome. And it's very true that peace in Syria will never be achieved if our regional allies continue to sabotage negotiations, which they are doing, as they continue to, the exclusion of the Kurds and other genuine democratic groups goes to show. If the Western powers continue to exclude the Kurds from talks in Geneva, which Russian foreign minister rightly noted has been done to please some of our regional allies, then they will be left with no choice but to create an independent state of their own, which of course will encourage the Kurds inside Turkey to do the same, further destabilizing that country. And the Kurds have, in fact, recently declared their intent to have a federal system for the areas of northern Syria under their control. Moreover, if peaceful groups with a stake in the country continue to be excluded on the ground that they are not involved in the fighting, then we are almost inviting them to pick up weapons and join the fray so they can actually get a seat at the table. As I have said on many occasions, only a political, diplomatic, and inclusive transition to democracy will allow Syria to achieve peace and remain free of instability and extremism. But this is not the direction in which things seem to be headed. This is because the talks at Geneva have largely become an arena for external powers to decide the fate of Syria. But the job of the UN is not to do the bidding of these powers by picking and choosing who should join the talks in line with what Turkey or Saudi Arabia or Qatar want. The job of the UN is to create an inclusive environment in which all Syrians are represented and can have a say in mapping out their destiny. We owe this to the Syrian people, and we cannot allow them to be left with the choice between dictatorship on one hand and Islamic theocracy on the other. That is not the path for peace. This leads me back to an important point. As well as rooting out existing terrorists at home and abroad, we also need to tackle Islamism as an ideology. Because as Pentagon's press secretary, Rear Admiral John Kirby has said, the center of gravity of our enemies is their ideology. And so, to ultimately defeat them, we must destroy this ideology. Now, in order to do this, we have to clamp down on the most dangerous channels of this hateful perversion of Islam on the internet, satellite TV station, and every other form of media through which vulnerable people can be recruited from their own bedrooms. Western countries can learn from the UK government in this regard, which not too long ago announced an exemplary new strategy to tackle the promotion of Islamism. This strategy includes banning radical preachers from posting material online and prevent anyone with convictions for extremist activity from working with children. Extremist disruption orders, as they are called, will stop individuals engaging in extremist behavior. and premises used to support extremism will be closed, and internet service providers will be forced to do more to remove extremist material and identify those responsible for it. As Prime Minister David Cameron says, it's not good leaving this simply to the police or the intelligence services. It's not good simply talking about violent extremism. We need to confront all extremism. This is, in fact, exactly what I've been saying for many years. But for too long, my words seem to have fallen on deaf ears. As British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond has admitted, the UK has been too reluctant in the past to recognize the link between non-violent extremism and violent extremism. And the UK, like other Western countries, has also been too reluctant to confront its so-called allies about their role in promoting this extremism. We really need to hold accountable and bring to justice all those who fund, incite, and give shelter to terrorists and extremists, whoever and wherever they may be, as they pose a direct threat to our national security. As French Prime Minister Manuel Valls just said recently, these people are about to win the ideological war. They're the ones the young generation listens to. So while it's all well and good to take measures to protect Western citizens from radicalization, unless we go after the root source of radicalization, which lies in Saudi, Qatar, and other exporters of extremism, there is little point to such actions. On this note, I would like to point to some remarks made by US Vice President Joe Biden during a talk to students at Harvard University in 2014, when Vice President Biden said that America's allies in the region were, quote unquote, our largest problem in Syria, and then went on to describe, just as I have here tonight, how the United States' regional allies had effectively started what he termed a proxy Sunni-Shia war in their determination to bring down the Syrian regime, deliberately cultivating groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Nusra, Islamic State, and others. None of this was unknown to informed observers of the region, but still, it was subsequently alleged that the vice president had apologized for raising these issues in public. To me, it seems totally unacceptable that the vice president of the most powerful country in the world should be apologizing for simply telling the truth. This episode reveals the complete inadequacy of the West's current policy towards its allies in the Middle East. Rather than coddling them, we need to name and shame individuals and states who are responsible for promoting division and hatred. And we have to ensure that counter-extremism strategies like the one unveiled by the British government are rolled out not only throughout the West, but more importantly throughout the Middle East. And that means insisting that our allies, including Turkey and the Gulf state, play their part in combating Islamism rather than deliberately encouraging and spreading it. Of course, we need to promote economic development and political freedom throughout the Islamic world and beyond so that young people there can face the future with hope instead of the despair and misery in which extremism thrives. And what won't happen overnight. But the Organization for Democracy and Freedom in Syria is committed for helping this development process for the long term. As the Iman Foundation, which I founded to promote dialogue, challenge extremism, and bring positive changes across the world, and I believe that organizations like the World Affairs Councils of America also have a vital role to play in this process. To conclude, I want to reiterate that the first step in bringing peace to my country and consequently greater security to the rest of the world is to recognize the severity of the crisis in Syria and its increasingly international character. That, however, requires us to recognize the underlying problem of Islamic extremism, which is a problem we must resolve to address with increased vigor and determination that the task truly deserves. Thank you very much.
You've just heard Ribal al-Assad, founder and director of the Organization for Freedom and Democracy in Syria, here on Speaking in Maine. You can find this program and others like it archived on our website, mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab for audio on demand. Charles Beck is our executive producer. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.